You know, a lot of churches at different times go through different, church growth ideas, go through different, theories and ideas. And one of the more common ones, popular ones in the last 10 or 20 years is something that is often called the seeker-sensitive or seeker-driven church movement. And the main idea of this is it teaches church leaders to develop their ministry based on marketing principles. And so what they say is the church should start by asking, what is it that the people in the community are looking for? And then let's organize the church, let's organize our efforts to give them what they think that they need. Because if our goal is to build the church, meaning our goal is to get more members, well, therefore, the most effective strategy is to do that on a marketing strategy and to try to give them what they want, that gives bring more people into the church. And but sometimes, we have to compromise a little bit. There was a number of years ago, someone wrote even a little cartoon that kind of made fun of this whole strategy. And they talked about the light church, and it's the church with 24% fewer commitments, home of the 7.5% tithe, 15-minute sermons, 45-minute worship services. We only have 8 commandments, your choice. You know, we use just 3 spiritual laws and have an 800-year millennium, everything you wanted in a church and less. And, and it's kind of a joke. It's kind of like a lot of times what we want is we want something that's, seeker-sensitive, more friendly. And in fact, one of the things that can happen with these churches is that a lot of times they now are trying to find new names that are more relevant, that don't sound churchy. And sometimes they can go too far with that. I mean, this is a real church sign, the cool church. And it just makes you look at that and you say, man, I wish our church was cool. And if we were the cool church, people would come to our church because we're cool. And but you get that idea that sometimes we can try a little too hard. Now here's one of the things, I'm mentioning this because one of the things that when you look at this approach to ministry that is most common in this approach is that when they look at that, they also make decisions about what they preach on based on that philosophy. So what they'll do is that they'll say, what we want to do is we want to preach topical messages, almost exclusively topical, rather than systematically studying through books of the Bible. And usually the topics they choose to preach on are issues that are considered by most people as practical. Ideas that seekers outside of the church would, see, that's something I want to know about. It's practical, it's enjoyable. And so the church generally picks what they consider practical subjects, and then they look in the Bible and they find a verse that talks about that subject or a couple of verses that kind of refer to that, and then they try to deal with that issue. Now, one of the things that happens, though, is that most of these churches will find that there are a number of subjects they deal with quite often, things like family and emotions and money and time and things like that. Well, there are other parts of the Bible, other subjects that hardly ever get dealt with because they are not what seekers want or they're not seen as practical. Now, I thought about that because when I thought about the passage that we're looking at today, I'm pretty sure it's a passage that a seeker-driven church would never touch. I mean, Dave read it a moment ago, and what is it? The last beatitude. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Now, they might like a lot of beatitudes, but that's one, it's kind of like, well, let's just kind of hop over that one. I think when you have the church leadership and they're sitting and saying, okay, now what is a practical message? What is it people want? No one's ever going to say, I think people really want to hear about the blessings of persecution. That's seeker sensitive. And it just doesn't pass the marketing test. That's going to draw people in. Let's put that on the billboard, persecution. And people are going to say, man, we want to hear that. See, it doesn't pass. I'm going to personally admit that as I began working on preparing this message, it's a difficult passage. It's not the first one that if I were to go through and say, well, let me just take themes from the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, this is one that you'd be tempted to skip over because it's difficult. And let's put it a different way. If you go to the bookstore and you go look at Christian books, the best-selling books don't have a whole lot of books on persecution. There might be a few books about talking about the persecution that is happening in the Mideast or somewhere like that, but there aren't many books that invite us to find the blessings of persecution. That just isn't a bestseller. It isn't written. And in fact, some of you might be thinking right here, it's like, how many of y'all excited? All right, We're talking about persecution today. That's what I was hoping to talk about. Wait, that's great. You know, I don't hear any amens. I don't hear that back. And in fact, I think there's probably someone sitting there thinking, I've been inviting friends for weeks, and they come today, and he talks about persecution. You know, what's he doing? And, you know, we sit there, and this is not what we are drawn towards. But before you try to slip out early, let me just mention a couple thoughts. First, I'm committed here to what's called an expository approach to Bible study, which means that we study through large sections of the Bible, verse by verse, section by section. Now, what that means is it forces us to deal with the whole Bible. If I were to choose the things that I felt comfortable with, you know, I would avoid this. But the fact of the matter is that I believe that a lot of times what God wants me to study aren't the parts that I want to study, but he knows that I need the parts that I don't want to study. And there's something that although it's difficult, we deal with difficult passages, the difficult passages are often even more necessary because we tend to avoid them. But second of all, we need to realize that while a passage like this is very difficult, that doesn't mean it's not practical. And so when you have churches that say, oh, we're practical messages, and well, how is persecution practical? What we're going to find is that the Bible is always practical. It's God's word. And I will tell you, if you ever come and you don't hear a practical message, it's not because the Bible wasn't practical, it's because I messed up. I screwed up. It's my failure. It's not the Bible's failure. The Bible is always practical. And I hope that by the end of our time this morning, that I will help you see how what he's saying here is incredibly practical into our lives. Now, as we dive into this, we've got to start by, again, looking and seeing that to understand this being the last of the Beatitudes, we've got to take a few minutes just to review and to see how this all fits into the whole, because it's an extension of what Jesus has started by saying. And so we need to, again, look at these foundational principles and understanding of the Sermon on the Mount. And first, again, what we've talked about the last couple weeks is that the Sermon on the Mount as a whole is all about discovering and living the blessed life. You know, the Beatitudes are an introduction to the whole of the Sermon on the Mount. And when they start off, what did they do? They start off with this repeated phrase, blessed. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Ending to this last one, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And the whole sermon is in essence saying the person who embraces and lives out this teaching will have discovered what it means to live the blessed life. Now, what is the blessed life? And we saw this again in the terminology here. The first and the last beatitude define what the blessed life is. Look, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The last one, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. More than anything, the blessed life at its core is to live as a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. It means to live the life that we were created for. To live as a citizen where we know that God reigns. God reigns in his life, in our life, and the peace and blessing that comes with his reign are the norm of our life. See, at the core of this promise that theirs is the kingdom of heaven is that we're promised the kingdom. Why? Because we have a relationship with the king. It's not just future. It's not that we will have the kingdom of heaven. It's that we do have. It's something that has a future reality to it because we have a relationship with the king. Now, we also have seen that as we see the Beatitudes, that these aren't describing different traits. A lot of times it's tempting to read, okay, first one, blessed are the poor in spirit. What's that? Well, that's a certain group of people. And those who mourn, that's another group of people. And those that pursue righteousness, that's another group. No, what we've seen is that these are not different traits of different people, but they're describing the character traits of the citizens of the kingdom, of one group of people. So if you are a citizen of the kingdom of God, if you are part of that one group of people, then all of these traits should be true in increasing measure in our lives. So that, you know, when we are here, we have this relationship with God. The first four we've seen describe what it means to enter into that relationship. So to enter into the relationship, we have to come to God and be poor in spirit. We have to mourn. We have to be meek and depend upon him. We have to hunger and thirst for righteousness that is not ours. That's how we enter into the relationship with God. That's how we become a citizen of God. And then the last ones then describe what it means to live out a citizen of our citizenship, to live a relationship with God. So we become transformed in our character because we now follow Christ. So we now, in every aspect of our life, we are different in our relationships and our desires and in our purpose and what we live for. So now here's what we need to realize, that when we talk about these things, now Jesus continues to explain them, and he teaches us that these character traits will now make us radically different than the rest of the world. We are, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians, new creations. We are new creatures. We are changed. Old things have passed away. New things have become new. Or all things have become new. We are now citizens of heaven, and as citizen of heaven, we now surrender our heart and mind and our life to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. We give him control over every aspect of who we are. And when we do this, you see, we give God the right to come in and to start to change us, and he does. He doesn't just change our behavior, he changes our character. He changes our heart. So we see everything through the prism of God and his lordship, the prism of his kingdom. And so he changes our relationships. So now our relationships are defined by mercy. It's not about, okay, us trying to use another person or get what we can. It's not about us earning our the love or reward. No, it's not about us looking for people and asking, okay, what can you do for me? No, our relationships are now defined by mercy, by showing grace and mercy to other people who have nothing to offer us, who need that grace and mercy. He changes our desires, so he makes us pure in heart, not just in our behavior. He changes our heart. And he changes our mission, our purpose in life, so we don't live for ourselves, but we now live as peacemakers. Now we have to ask, okay, how does that all relate to the last beatitude when he says, now blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And the answer is this. We are radically different people, and God now calls us to live out that change practically in the everyday life. When he calls us to change our character, this is not something that is private. You know, what does it mean to live as citizens of heaven? It's not something that's just private. It's really easy to think of terms in private terms. Okay, well, God changes me, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to church, and I'm going to change, and I'm going to go home, and I'm going to be that way, and then we go out, and we're not that different than the rest of the world. No, it's not a private transformation that God does. It's something that changes our character, and that is something that we then live out publicly. You see, when we look at the Beatitudes, when you look at what's going on, it's a transformation. And it's clear when you look at the next verses. You look, we go through the Beatitudes. He just finishes the Beatitudes and where we're looking at verse 12 today. But then look what it says in the next verses, starting in verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. And then he says in verse 14, and you are the light of the world. The city I set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand. And it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. And what he's saying is he calls us to live these traits out not privately, not in isolation, but publicly, to be salt that is rubbing into the world, to be light that's shining into the world. It's not, these traits aren't lived out privately in isolation, but publicly as we engage our world. Now here's what happens, is when we are radically different and we're living that out and expressing it in our world, in our actions and our words, how does the world respond to that? You know, they talk about the whack-a-mole. If you have somebody stands up, you know, somebody that's different, you always get whacked, right? You know, so what do? We conform. We just look like everyone else. If you conform, you're not going to face any opposition. But when we're radically different, when we live in a way that is radically different, openly in the world, so that we're salt and light, so that we cannot be missed, well, we've got to realize that the world's not always going to affirm that. It's going to resist it and oppose it and even persecute. Put another way, we are called to be radically different and become like Jesus. Okay, how did the world respond to Jesus? They put him to death. And so if we understand that, we've got to realize that we shouldn't be surprised. Now, again, we're going to look at this a lot more in 2 weeks, but let's look very briefly at some of how or what he's calling us to do here. He's calling us, first of all, to live out as salt. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. So he's called us to be salt. And as salt, we're called to be a preservative influence in a decaying world. Now, when we use salt in our day, we usually think of it as a seasoning, as a flavoring. And so, you know, some people are, you know, you just sit there and you get an order from the restaurant. First thing you do, you don't even try it. You just dump on the salt. I mean, you ever with people like that, you know, you're just like, well, at least try it first of all. You know, see if it's good. But, you know, but some people, they just pour on the salt. A lot of us, you know, we put on salt. I've had blood pressure. I can't put on salt anymore. But for us, when we think of salt, it's seasoning. It seasons the taste. It draws out taste. Now, there's some of that that's true. But in that day, the primary purpose of salt wasn't as a seasoning. It was as a preservative. Now, you've got to remember, in that day, you didn't have refrigerators. Nor did you have marketplaces in the sense where you just go buy a steak or a hamburger for the day. I mean, you were generally there, and especially if you lived out in the field, you had your own animals, and when you needed meat, you would go and you would slaughter one of your animals. And generally, you wouldn't eat that whole animal at that time. So then you eat this, and what happens when you take meat? What happens if you have meat and you leave it out, you know, outside? If you leave it hot weather, hot, you know, like it was there, there's no refrigeration, it quickly begins to spoil, it decays. Now, so what do? They don't want to just eat a little bit and let the rest decay. They would then try to preserve it. So they would preserve it by salting the meat. And so, for example, we know that, you know, you think of beef jerky and things like that. All that is heavily salted meat. So you have this preservative of salt that is keeping this meat from spoiling. So that's what they would do, is that they would rub the salt into the meat, keep it from, you know, from spoiling. It would preserve its freshness. Now, when you look at that, it's teaching something really significant about our world. It's teaching that our world is decaying. Our world is in the process of decaying, spiritually, you know, relationally, morally. Now, the people in the world were saying, well, no, we're not decaying. We're evolving. We're getting better. And we have this evolution perception that we're getting better and that we're understanding more. Well, no, biblically, it's saying, no, we're not evolving. We're rotting. And all you have to do is to look at the effects of the decisions of the world. The further that we get away from God and the decisions that you make, look at the effects and you see more and more brokenness in the world. Why? Because the natural state apart from God is decay. It's not only that the natural state is decay, it's saying now as the church, you realize that the only hope for a decaying world is the gospel. It's only if we take the gospel and that as we live out the gospel into our world, as we proclaim the gospel and live out biblical truths, that will stem the decay, that will bring freshness. That's the one thing that will, you know, that will stem the decay. And historically, I believe that the greater the influence that the Bible has had on our culture, even if everyone wasn't a believer, the greater the influence the church and the Bible has at the culture, the healthier the culture has been. And the further we move away from that, the more that we remove the salt, the more we see the decay and the rot. So the problem is that when we look at that, people don't want to hear that message. People don't want to hear that the world is decaying. People don't want to hear that their life is decaying. People don't want to hear that they have a sin problem. So what happens? What happens when we live that out? You see, we get rejected. People get angry. I think of what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 4. He says this, For the time that has passed suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. He's basically saying, you know, we used to do this. You know, if you came to Christ as an adult, you know, we could say, yeah, I did a lot of those things. That was my past. And he said, okay, but we don't need to do that anymore. And now with respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery and they malign you. Now here's what happens. As you have people, I know there are people in the church that this is what you experience. I mean, we used to do this. We have friends that were involved in this. And now we say, okay, I come to know Christ. I don't want to do this anymore. God has changed my lifestyle. I don't need to be defined by that anymore. So you know, boy, we used to go out to drink with your friends. And I know, I've talked to people that this is exactly your story. You used to go out, you used to get drunk with your friends, and now you choose not to. Now, deep down, they know that their drinking is destroying their life. Deep down, they know that's a bad thing. Deep down, it's hurting their relationships. It's costing them money. It's, you know, they know that. But what happens when you stop going out and getting drunk with them? They start to mock you. They start to malign you. They start to get angry and criticize you for not doing it anymore. Why? Because they don't know how to stop. They know that they're rotting, but the fact is that when you pull out of that, they'll attack you for failing to choose the action of decay. Or let's take another example. You know, you have friends that are always talking about members of the opposite sex, and they're flirting with them in the office, or maybe they go to the strip club or whatever, but deep down, they know that this is harmful to their marriage. They know that. They know it's hurting their relationship. But then when you just choose not to do those things, and when you talk about, well, and inviting them to church or what God's teaching you, they get angry with you. They malign you, they attack you, they criticize you. Now, deep down, they know that what they're doing is decaying, it's hurting, but still they hate you for the difference that you show. Or another example, you know, somebody engaged in all kinds of gossip at the office, and that was what you used to do, and now you don't do it anymore. Now, deep down, those people know that it destroys trust. They know it's hurting relationships. They know what it is to be the recipients of that gossip and how much it's hurt them. They know that, but they're now angry with you for failing to do that. Because why? Because when salt rubs into the world, it exposes the decay, and we don't like our decay to be exposed. And so people will attack us, they will malign us, they will accuse us for even living out the lifestyle that they know deep down they want to leave. So when you think of that, how does our culture respond to salt? It's exactly what's saying here. They malign us. Another translation says in 1 Peter that they heap abuse on us. Matthew 5, Jesus says, they will persecute you because they don't understand. And a changed life is something that exposes their need. It exposes the rot that deep down that they know is there, but they don't want to admit. So we're not only called to be salt, we're called to be light. Again, Matthew 5, verse 14. You are a light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand. And it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Now, what is light? Light is truth. We are called to be light, which is beacons of truth in a lost and confused world. In a world where we don't know what's true anymore, we're making it up as we go. We have a new expert that comes out every 10 years who totally denies what we knew 10 years ago now, but now everybody should listen to this person because now we understand. And it continues to lead more and more people off the cliff of destruction. And what is light? It means that we live out truth. It's not just that we stand up and proclaim it. It's we proclaim it with our lifestyle. Let them see the light of your good deeds. So it's what we do and what we say. It's what we live out. But the problem is the world doesn't always like the light. Look what it said about Jesus in John chapter 3. And this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light lest his work should be exposed. Now, the fact is about light, there's something about it that draws us because we know we need it, and there's something about it that offends us and repels us. And we're told that this was true about Jesus Christ. So if it was true about Jesus, should we be surprised that it's true about us? See, what happens? How does our culture respond to the light? Initially, it rejects it. Initially, there's an exposure, there's a hatred. And again, even when we don't say anything, when we just live out our values, because there's an exposure, even while deep down they know I'm lost and I desperately need it. And if we live it out, sooner or later, some of those people who will reject us will eventually say, can you tell me about that? You know, there's a little illustration I came across that I think says it so well. There's a story about a foggy night at sea, and a sea captain saw what appeared to be lights of another ship coming towards him. And he instructed a single man to contact the other ship by a signal light with the following message. Change your course by 10 degrees to the north. The reply came, no, change your course 10 degrees to the south. The captain responded, I am a captain of the U.S. Navy. Change your course 10 degrees to the north. He was angered when he saw the single light come back. I am seaman first class. Change your course 10 degrees to the south. Incensed now, the captain came back and said, I am the Nimitz. I am a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier. Change your course 10 degrees to the north. The reply came back, I'm a lighthouse. Change your course 10 degrees to the south. So now that's what happens is we sit there and we say, I want to be right, and I'm mad that somebody's telling me that I'm wrong. But the fact of the matter is you could sit there and say, well, I'm the captain, and you have to agree to me, but you're not moving the cliffs. See, but our world doesn't want to hear the lighthouse. We want to say, this is my right. You can't tell me that I'm wrong. You can't tell me. You can't, don't judge me. You know, and our job is to say, no, we are proclaiming the lighthouse. And if you don't change your course, you're going to crash against the rocks. And we say that not out of judgment, but out of love and compassion, because it's true. So when you understand these things, what you understand is that all the, you know, the things that are in the Sermon on the Mount, even the character traits as they're lived out, they shine in a way that is so radically different than the rest of the culture, it's going to offend. You know, we're called to be people of mercy. Blessed are the merciful. But you know what? We live in a dog-eat-dog world. And we live in a world where merciful people are taken advantage of. Or we're going to tell people, you know, get this or get this, you know, take advantage of it. And I mean, I remember a friend of mine who's trying to live out his Christian life. And he kept getting taken advantage of this by this business partner. And even when they tried to resolve it, the thing is that everybody kept taking advantage of him because they knew he was merciful and he would be kind. And the other guy was like, well, I can tweak that. I can take advantage of it. And that happens. Or it calls us to be radically different, to be pure in heart. But you know what? When we live as people that are pure in heart, we live by a standard that is not defined by ourselves. We recognize that we are citizens of the kingdom of God. And purity is defined not by my opinion or by the culture's opinion. It's defined by God and his opinion. And if I live out saying I am trying to honor God by being pure in heart as he defines it, that will always be offensive to people in the world who want to reject the idea that there is a standard outside of themselves. He calls us to be radically different in our purpose, to be peacemakers. But you know what? To be a peacemaker, we have to realize that our core problem isn't that my argument with another person. It isn't arguments between nations. Our core problem is that we're sinners. Our core problem is a lack of peace in our relationship with God. And it's not until you have peace with relationship with God that you'll really ever know how to be able to make peace with other people. Now, if I now come and as a peacemaker and say, well, here's how you make peace. Now, you need to get right with God. You got a sin problem. You know what? People are going to resent that. They're going to be angry. They're going to reject. They're going to persecute those who carry out that message. See, now, when we look at this, we've got to understand that what he's teaching there here, though, teaches something about the nature and basis of persecution, because we can get this wrong. See, a lot of times when you think of Christians, you know, I can think of a lot of Christians who are persecuted, but a lot of times their persecution is maybe because of their personality. And what does it say? Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. He promises blessings only when we are persecuted for righteousness' sake. When we're standing out for truth, when we're proclaiming the truth, when we're not compromising on beliefs, when we're not compromising on our moral standards, he doesn't say, blessed are you who are persecuted, end of story. No. You know, I can be a jerk and be persecuted, and I'm not blessed because of that, because I'm not being persecuted for righteousness' sake. I'm being persecuted because I'm a stubborn jerk. Or because I'm ungracious in what I say, or I'm unloving. Not only that, it's not only blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, but then look what he says in verse 11. He takes it even a little deeper. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. We're blessed not just because we're opposed, but we're blessed only when we're opposed and persecuted on account of Jesus. When what people don't like about us is our connection to Jesus Christ. You know, I find this amazing. I mean, even now you have, the Muslim faith, and you have people that are, obviously, so many people that are out there that are, you know, claiming in the name of Islam, going out and killing people. But how often do you hear the Muslim faith being attacked in the culture? It's defended. You can't say that people do that for that reason. Could you imagine one Christian who went out, you had one guy back in the 1990s that went out and claimed to be a Christian and killed an abortion doctor. And we heard about that for a decade. I mean, you have how much hatred is being given towards Christianity. How much opposition, how many people are now, you know, literally losing their jobs, losing their livelihood because they're trying to stand on their beliefs and they're being fired for one reason or another because they're standing on that. Why? Because the opposition is not towards religion, not towards God, but towards Jesus Christ, towards Christianity. And we need to realize that God calls us to live not only as moral people, but people that are known for their faith in Jesus Christ. Look what Jesus said about this in John chapter 15. If the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than its master. And if they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. And if they kept my word, they will also keep yours. And so what he's saying here is that we need to understand that we shouldn't be surprised by this. Now, we've talked a lot about all these different aspects of persecution, but there's one part that we haven't gotten to yet, which is really important. And that is we've got to ask, how in the world are we blessed because of this? I mean, the promise is, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Now, how are we blessed? How do we receive something through persecution that we wouldn't have otherwise? Where is the blessing? We understand why, we understand the nature, but where in the world is the blessing? I want you to see something here. There's a couple things that when you read the whole section, you see. You know, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Now, the first question is, when we look at this, what is the blessing? There's a contrast. There's a contrast between what God has to offer and what the world has to offer. So blessed are you. God will call you blessed. God will give you the kingdom of God, not only in the future, but he will give you some of the benefits of that even in the present. Blessed are you. God will bless you with spiritual blessings, with spiritual realities, even when the world takes those away or threatens those. Do you see what it's saying? What is the persecution? The persecution is to say, you know, you might lose face, you might lose, you know, you might lose credibility, you might lose friends, you might lose your job, you might lose money, you might lose all the things that the world has is threatening us. What is it? It's things that we value in this life by the world standards. And what Jesus is saying, what you need to realize is there's a contrast. God is going to say, I'm going to bless you with spiritual realities, not only eternally, but even in the here and now. Yours will be the kingdom of God, and you are blessed with that even when the world is threatening to take away the things that the world says is valuable. I love a quote, one of the famous quotes by a guy named Jim Elliot, who was a missionary ultimately killed on the mission field, and he said this. He said, he is no fool that gives up what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. See, it's understanding that what I'm doing is that I'm living for the things that I cannot, you know, that I cannot lose, and I'm willing to give up the things that I cannot keep to gain that which I cannot lose. But it's not only that, there's also another contrast here. Look at verse 11. Blessed are you when others revile against you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. The persecution specifically is speech. Blessed are you when people attack you and say things about you. Now, what is the blessing? What you need to realize is that God pronounced you blessed even when people in the world are pronouncing you cursed. Even when the people in the world are saying, this is bad about you. They're calling you, you know, all kinds of evil falsely on my account. When they're persecuting, reviling you, when they're hating you. And the question is here, who are we listening to? You see, what treasure, first one, what treasure are we more motivated by? Are we more motivated by the reward, the treasure that God will give us, or by the treasure that the world will give us? Because at the end of the day, we're going to give up one treasure to gain the other one. What treasure is more real to you? Okay, and the second question, what voice is more real to you? See, I'm not saying don't care about what people say about you. We all care about what people say about us. All of us, some of our value, much of our value is dependent on what other people say about us. And that's not wrong. The question is, whose voice are we listening to? Are we more motivated by the voice of the world, by the people that are accusing us, that are persecuting us, that are tearing us down, or are we more motivated by the affirmation of God? What is more real to us? Maybe the best way I can explain this just in closing is to share some of the ideas of how God has taught me this over the years. Now, when I say this, can I say that I've ever been persecuted for righteousness' sake? Well, if I think about the Christians in the Middle East who are being put to death by followers of ISIS, I've never experienced that. I've never been threatened with that. I've never been close to that. But I have faced significant opposition, and I face consequences for living out my faith by refusing to compromise. One example, a number of years ago, I was pressured by a boss to falsify reports for my work. And he made it clear that my future employment would be dependent on my following his instructions. And that's hard. And I thought about, I prayed about it. I struggled with what to do. And at the end of the day, without sharing the whole question, you know, or the whole story, you know, I said, okay, I can't do that. And I submitted the report he called me to do, but I did not falsify. I did not tell the lies that he told me that I had to tell. And that led to a process where ultimately I lost my job. Now, there were people in the organization who knew that what I was, even his bosses, knew that what I was doing was right. They knew about the story, but they were afraid to, you know, they were afraid to expose it. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I paid the consequence of it. Now, was that great, blessed, I'm persecuted? No, at the time, it was terrible. I mean, at that time, we were expecting our first child, and to lose your job at that point in time didn't seem like a blessing. But you know what? I am blessed because of that persecution. Because truth and time went hand in hand, and God protected me, and God developed, not only developed my character so that I can talk to my kids and teach them about not compromising and say, I've been down that path, here are the prices that I paid. But he also affirmed that, and at times opened up whole other doors of life and of ministry because of the character that was demonstrated and being willing to pay that price. It didn't feel like blessing, but you know what? I am blessed because of it. Or when I think about what people say about you, the latter part, you know, blessed are those when people revile you and persecute and utter all kinds of evil. I want to tell you, I understand this. I'm by nature a people pleaser. I think most people in ministry are. You know, we want to please people. I know that's not healthy. Well, then God put me in a situation, unfortunately, I have to admit, a ministry where it was a ministry where compromise had been the norm. And as we try to do what's right and stand out in truth and talk about what we need to do, there was tremendous opposition, tremendous persecution. And I remember at numerous times talking to my wife and saying, I know we can make this easier. If I just stop trying to do what's right, if I just compromise, life would be easier, I'd get everybody's approval, and it would get a whole lot easier. But that's not what God called me to do. And so I persevered, and you know what? I've got a lot of scars on me. And I went through a very, very long period of time where we faced tremendous opposition, was extremely difficult. Now, am I blessed because of that? I can tell you, in that time, it sure didn't feel like blessing. But you know what? People even now, they'll talk about, boy, you know, thank you for stating truth and for not compromising. You know why I don't compromise? Because I have paid the price. I have been there and I have felt the pain. I have felt the opposition. And you know what? I have paid the price and I've said, okay, I'm going to do that. And how do I do it? God, help me to be faithful. Help me to listen to you. Am I doing right? I'm seeking counsel. Do I have your approval? And you know what? In the persecution, I learned what it means to be able to stand strong because I listen to God's voice more than everyone else's. And I'm a whole lot stronger. I'm a whole lot more courageous. I'm a better person because of it. Was it a blessing then? No. Am I blessed? Yes. These are blessings that we don't necessarily pursue. It's like, hey, great, let's go be persecuted. But you know what? They are worth it. It is practical. It is everyday life, and they are worth it. So just close some closing thoughts. I'm not going to write these down for you, but I'm going to give you three questions. You write down the one that sticks to you. Really, the core question is this. Who do you believe? That's the core question. Who do you believe? Because when you look at this, what we're talking is about rewards. Are you more motivated by the reward of the world or the rewards of God? Because persecution is going to say, we're going to threaten the rewards of the world, the things that you value here. And God says, if you stay faithful, I will reward you. Who do you believe? And whose approval is more important to you? Because the world will say, well, if you follow God, we're going to revile you. We're going to accuse you. We're going to accuse you of evil for following God. And God says, stay faithful and I will affirm you. And truth and time will go hand in hand. Who are you going to believe? Whose approval is more important to you? And my friends, these are hard issues, but they're practical issues. They play out in everyday life. And I pray that as you understand and you live those out, we are called to be radically different. And being radically different people will not always be something that will be affirmed. Not in the world's eyes, but it will be in God's eyes. And there will be times that we face opposition. We will face persecution. We'll face hatred. We'll face many people who will say things that are not at all true about us. But if we realize that our ultimate audience is God, that our ultimate reward is from Him, that we will learn to be people that have the confidence and have the courage to live without compromise, because we know that we're living for His approval and His reward.